Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive these programs on the radio show page at richarddugan.com, and we are rebroadcast on a2zen.fm. You'll need to go to that website, a2zen, that's a2zen.fm, and check their listings to see when they're running the program during the week. It's at different times. It moves around a little bit. That's all right, because we'll hit different folks and different mindsets, and that's a very good thing. And again, we do thank you so much for sharing this hour with us as we delve into those new paradigms for a new world and try to find out where our guests are coming from. We get to travel into their world, see where they have been and where they are, and maybe even find out where they're going. Sometimes our guests don't know where they're going, but that's part of the fun of the journey, is enjoying that aspect of this program. Well, today we're going to be traveling back and forth and back and forth and back and forth from east to west and west to east, and who knows what we're going to find in between. We're going to be talking with the author of East Meets West. East, say hello to West. West, say hello to East. John Adago is my guest, and this is the story of the remarkable men and women in the East and the West who built a bridge across a cultural divide and introduced meditation, Eastern philosophy, to the West. And there are some folks that I associated with back in the 80s and early 90s, John, who would take great offense, be quite put upon by the fact that we have brought these other philosophies other than the Judeo-Christian philosophical mindset, if you will, into America, which is claimed to be a Christian nation. We won't necessarily get into those debates, but nonetheless, it happened, and I don't think there was any way of stopping it any more than there was any way of stopping you from being on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit. One of the first things that came to mind when I read the title of the book, because I've heard this phrase over and over, East Meets West. And what, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the West doesn't have a whole lot to offer the East. It's the East that has the greater possibility of introducing us to things we've never heard of before, maybe even never thought of before. I mean, we're just newbies. I mean, you know, maybe a thousand years old at the most here in the West. And I guess that we maybe need to define, well, what do we mean by the West? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as one of the teachers I discuss in East Meets West, Gurdjieff, said, It's imperative that the energy of the East, of the energy of the West, and the wisdom of the East merge. Certainly, there was an exchange. The ancient spiritual sciences teachings of Vedanta, as they were practiced in India for a millennium, were unavailable in Europe and America up until recently, the latter half of the 20th century. And certainly that coming to the West has had a profound effect on the way people view their spirituality and the way they understand their religion. But they're not incompatible by any means.
Well, I guess that's one of the struggles that I dealt with for roughly 15 years throughout the decade of the 80s and half of the 90s was the fact that there was a real problem with the messages that were coming out of the East. And yet some of our biggest most famous or infamous individuals, both we'll say from Europe as well as the United States, would travel to the East, would travel to India in particular, and study with these gurus in particular, and bring back this philosophy that was at least foreign to the Western mindset, and maybe at most some thought it was a threat to what the West had to offer from their perspective, and that was the more modern, if you will, theology or doctrine, if you will, from Christendom. You know, I mean, many people even today, we still struggle with that. So when you, and I noticed that I was going through the book and I was noticing some of the dates of many of the people in here, many of them, there were, I don't know, four or five individuals, all passed away in 1982. Somehow, because I do not believe in coincidences, but I do believe in coincidences. What was going on in 1982 that took some of these folks from us is very interesting. And I just kind of see these kinds of patterns. But you've tracked down these folks. You've researched this in terms of these particular individuals. But what about the others who were into what was it collectively that these folks in your book were into that, say, the folks of who founded, say, Christian Science or the Unitarian churches or some of these other, shall we say, denominations? What was different about the folks in your book to some of these others that are more notable? Because most of the names in this book, and maybe I don't travel in the right circles, John, are unfamiliar to me.
Yes, I think that would be the case. This book, East Meets West, tells the stories of some of the remarkable men and women who endeavored to build a bridge to unite two cultures. I began with Gurdjieff in the beginning of the 20th century, who, with a small group of people, actually made expeditions to the East in search of knowledge, that they felt that there was a body or system of knowledge that was not readily accessible in the West. They had studied the traditional sources of religion and philosophy and science, and what they found there led them to believe that there was something more. As one of the people I write about, a Russian philosopher by the name of Uspensky, he said that he traveled to India because he was looking for groups or schools. He realized that his personal or individual efforts were insufficient. He was struck by the labyrinth of contradictions in which we live our everyday life. He said he was seeking the miraculous, which was the title of his book. And what he meant by that was that he wanted to penetrate beneath the thin film of our superficial life to a deeper, more profound reality. It seemed to him that that way could be found in the East, and that's where he looked. This does not in any way conflict with the Judeo-Christian tradition. I was raised a Catholic. When I began to study Eastern philosophy, one of the questions becomes, well, how do I reconcile my tradition, my religion, with this philosophy? In fact, I devote the last chapter of my book to that subject because it was a very serious question for me, and I think for many people. What I found was that the study of Eastern philosophy actually lent a more profound understanding to my Christian background. And when I read the Gospels in the light of these philosophies, there was a deeper understanding. And also, I found that when I then looked at the Gospels and the words of Jesus, I found that they gave a deeper, more profound understanding that these teachers in the East were professing. So I found a unity, and that, in fact, is the Vedanta philosophy of India is a philosophy of unity, a philosophy that speaks of one God, one truth, one consciousness. And what it professes that is essentially men and women are the same and have been the same. We want the same things. We seek the same happiness, peace, knowledge, fulfillment. These things don't change. And although the forms of different religious practices in different cultures and different times appear quite different, the essential philosophy is the same.
And what I'm noticing is that that is what we're starting to term what it is that we are wanting to learn, what we are learning, whether we're studying Eastern or Western or Buddhism or Zen, you know, the Zen religions or what have you. And instead of calling it a religion, we're saying it's a philosophy, because it's an internal process, always has been, and it's not something that we are wanting to put on to other people. We want to share it, but there's a difference between you and I sharing our philosophical perspectives on God and the universe and heaven and hell and the good and evil and so forth, and somebody who is saying, this is the way that it is, and if you don't follow this path, then a pox upon you and your household, so to speak.
Well, one of the things that my personal journey came to the conclusion that each individual has to find his own way back to the center. It's as if we were all on a circumference of a circle. The center is the same, but each of us is, in fact, unique, and so our angle of approach is slightly different. We may even approach it from diametrically opposed directions. As we get closer to the center, it becomes more unified. And in fact, the center is unity. It's the same for all.
You have a quote in Appendix 3 entitled Philosophy and Christianity that sort of speaks to what we're talking about here. And I would ask you to pronounce the gentleman's name, because I'm going to butcher it. Who is the gentleman that's quoted here speaking in New York in 1998?
Mr. Jaiswal.
Jaiswal.
That quote had a very profound effect on me. What he said was, first he said, it's not our business to make Christian of Hindi or Hindi of Christian. And this was a man of Indian denomination who was speaking, though he had spent most of his life in England. But he said, the religion that you're born into is a gift from God. And there's great value in these traditions, and you would be wise to practice your religion. So he was speaking to a group of philosophers and philosophy students, but he did not in any way negate spirituality or negate religion.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Vedanta philosophy in India, and you also have the practice of Hinduism, which is a religion, which is, although it encompasses and overlaps in many places, it has its own unique rituals and ceremonies.
So I would say that maybe there should be a rule, an additional rule to all philosophical movements, and that is, until you have perfected this philosophy, do not go and try and convert others to it. And that will take you a lifetime. And so it'll keep everyone occupied in that regard. I'm also curious about a symbol that embodies three universal laws, and it's referred to as an enneagram. I'd like you to describe that to our listeners and how it plays into this discussion of the East sharing its philosophy with the West. And I think I understand better now, the West shares its energy, its youthful exuberance, if you will, with the East.
Very important, because the East has languished in a certain way. There's a certain inertia there. And it certainly lagged far behind in technology and in development of the physical sciences, because their view is a bit more universalist, whereas in the West the view was more individualist. And the individualistic view led to this progress in a sense in the conquering of nature. Because what we sought was freedom from want and poverty. In the East, the inquiry was in governed by ancient tradition. They were interested in conquering desire, freedom from suffering. They sought to lift the veil of illusion that keep men and women from reaching their highest potential. So it wasn't that there was no inquiry taking place, but it was a different inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And during the 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, we saw a profound exchange. the energy and the technology and the business acumen in the West have begun to alleviate the conditions of poverty and inertia in the East. And conversely, the philosophy of the East has had a profound effect on Europe and America.
I have to say that I've often felt when I would hear the term that we were going to export democracy, for example, to the rest of the world, I thought, really? Can you see what it's done to us? And you're going to share this with, it's like sharing the plague in one sense, because we were, you know, all we had so many of the downsides, you know, obesity and gluttony and hoarding and greed and all of those, I guess, the seven deadly sins, you might say, from Catholicism. And I thought, why are we doing that to the rest of the world? Let them evolve in their own way, so to speak. Let's invoke the prime directive here. But we all live here together, and it's like you're, I think what you're saying in this context about putting all of these elements together, there is a, if you will, a happy medium, isn't there?
Well, yes. As Mr. Jaiswal went on to say, it's not a matter of individualism or universalist. What is important is freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this particular freedom that he was speaking about. He was talking about freedom from that which binds us. In society, one of the benefits of democracy is we're free to pursue a path. There's no restriction on what we read or what we hear or the way we lead a good part of our lives. It's not interfered with. But what these philosophers spoke about was men and women that reach a time in their life where they seek to be more than what they are, where they seek freedom from their habits, the limitations, their associations. They reach a point in their life, as one of the teachers in East Meets West expressed it, his name was Mr. Wilhelm Nyland, and he spoke about something that he called the work, which is an effort that one exerts. And he said, it begins with a wish to be more than what I am because I'm dissatisfied with the condition I find myself in, bound by habit, forgetting who and what and even where I am. It's not enough to live in this ordinary state. I wish to wake up, to awaken a faculty, to create something that can observe myself, something that's impartial, not bound by judgments or criticisms. And he said, it's myself that I remember. It's my birthright. But it's only mine when I make an effort. What these philosophers taught was the knowledge on how one could begin to make that effort if they've reached a time in their life where they had a yearning or a craving for something more.
And that is not something that is taught. It is not something that is given. It is something that each one of us already has, isn't it?
It is your birthright, but it's only your birthright if you make an effort to discover it and nurture it.
And I believe it was also Ouspensky, who also is quoted here as saying, in regards to the work, one needs to work along three lines. The first is work on oneself, to remember oneself. The second line is work for and with others, to acknowledge the self in others. And the third line is work for the sake of the work. Not work for the sake of work. We're not talking about the consumer-producer aspect of work, 9-to-5 here. We're talking, and maybe I should ask you to define what he's referring to, the work, I mean, you started to just a few moments ago, the work of our life's purpose, that yearning,
yes,
as you talked about.
Yeah, so the work for the sake of, it could be the tradition or for the good of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
If one has to appreciate that people that begin to engage in spiritual work and meditation and study and contemplation in an effort to refine their lives, to refine the quality of their attention, to expand the radius of their awareness. People who do this work have to remember that this kind of work is not done for personal gain. It's done for all.
Yeah.
The analogy is a man in a church tower ringing a bell. He's not making that beautiful sound for his own enjoyment. It's reaching out over time and space. It affects others, many of whom he may never even know or meet.
Mm.
And the work is like that. So, but we have to begin with ourselves, learning about who and what I am.
Yeah.
Taking a beginning of a look at the limitations and how, as Gurdjieff said, we might strive to overcome these limitations. We have to become people of substance. And as that progresses, that development progresses, we become more of use, we become people of substance, more of use to others. And that's what everyone wants. They want to be a better spouse, a better parent, better in their profession, a more worthwhile member of their community. Human beings want to live in harmony and intelligence. And yet we find in our everyday state of awareness, I mean, we get along. We manage to find our way to work and back to home without getting lost.
But sometimes most of the time.
A wrong turn. You know, and sometimes in the morning we can't find our keys.
Yeah.
Our wallet, and we, you know, dial a wrong number, and we speak and act in ways quite inappropriate to the situation of the moment. And, you know, once in a while, we pause and say, wait a minute. There must be a higher, finer state of awareness and attention than this. And as you said, this doesn't come as a part of the natural progression of a life. It's not taught to us in school. The knowledge to refine our lives, to deepen the sense, the profound sense of the meaning of a human life, requires knowledge, higher knowledge. And that's what these teachers in East Meets West sought out. These were teachers in the West that turned to the East looking for something that they were having trouble finding where they were. They could sense that it existed. If you investigate religion and philosophy and science, you sense that there's this all-encompassing unity. But it wasn't. They couldn't find the practical approach. What is it that I actually do when I get up in the morning?
Yeah.
And so they turned to the East, and what they met were some teachers who had around, after the devastation of World War II, there were a group of religious spiritual leaders in India that felt it was essential that the knowledge of the East reach out to the West. It was a matter of survival. And they began to work in that direction. One of them was the Maharishi,
mm-hmm.
who in 1960 came to London with a form of meditation he was tremendously successful in promulgating that practice. The history, part of the history that's discussed in East Meets West is that prior to 1945, meditation, first of all, was virtually unknown in the West. During the last 50 years, it's become a household word, along
yeah.
with unity and yoga and awareness and karma and mantra.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are part of our vocabulary today. In 1950, that was not at all the case. There's really been quite a dramatic shift in awareness as a result of this influence of the Eastern teachers.
Very much so. We're going to continue this discussion. John, I am fascinated by what you have to share here in your work and in our conversation, and we are going to come back in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We're talking about East Meets West, the book by John Adago. I'm going to ask you to stay with us, and we'll be right back here on Tell Me Your Story.
Talk with me.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for staying with us as we are talking with John Adago about his work, his book, East Meets West, and the long subtitle, if you will, is the stories of the remarkable men and women in the East and West who built a bridge across a cultural divide that introduced meditation, Eastern philosophy, and other things to the West. And John, again, thank you for staying with us. I wanted to jump into something real quickly here because this struck me so fascinatingly back in the late 80s, early 90s. and not just working for the Christian radio station, but the passage that I've done a little research on, the truth, this is attributed to Jesus, being quoted as, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Some of the research I've done is that actually that last portion says that the truth shall make you free. And I was talking with a professor of philosophy just a few days ago in regards to the difference between those two phrases, or in injecting either of those two words. And it was fascinating, the conversation he and I had. But what I wanted to share with you and have you elaborate on was the fact that I found it so, like you, I found the some of the answers that I was getting from people, they just didn't make sense. And I remember reading where, for example, the historical record, if you will, whatever there may be, of crucifixions in the days of Jesus, where the final indignation was that they were stripped naked on the cross before they died. And it was the ultimate humiliation, if you will. And so I remember asking a priest the question, why? If the truth will set me free, why aren't you people, why isn't the hierarchy telling me the truth? That seems to be a significant one. And his answer, which struck me, and he was very calm about it. I mean, there was matter of fact about it. He says, well, the reason we don't do that is because we don't want to upset the sensibilities of the people. And I thought, well, but wait a minute. That's what the truth ends up doing anyway. When we find, and when it says, ye shall know the truth, I don't think it's referring to a single truth that somebody is saying, this is the truth. Believe it. It's like knowing that you know that you know. That is a truth for you as an individual. And that sets you or makes you free. What are your thoughts on that?
The Eastern teachers that I write about in East Meets West are very clear that this higher knowledge needs to be sought after. It cannot be given. Gurdjieff said, I can give you knowledge, I can create propitious conditions, but I cannot help you. Someone can teach you a method of meditation, but it has to be you that nurtures that practice once they've been given it, makes the space in their day, in their life. And if one begins to value the peace and stillness that they find in a short period of meditation, well, then they begin to alter their life a bit so that the conditions make are more suitable for that practice to grow in their life. So Jesus said, seek and ye shall find. Mm-hmm. Knock and it shall be answered. But you have to seek. Mm-hmm. You have to ask. You have to knock at the door. And in every generation, it's available to some people to become what we could call free of the human condition. They begin to strive for a deeper understanding, an expanded state of awareness, a refined condition of attention. But this, first of all, requires some work. It requires knowledge, and it requires some study and some contemplation and some effort on the part of the seeker. And so it's not for everyone. It's just for those who want it. Now, that's fair enough.
It's right there. It's sitting right there for you if you want it.
Well, and that's the extraordinary thing about our lifetime. This wisdom was not generally available 50 years ago. I mean, these people, these Westerners, you know, they traveled to journeys to inaccessible places. They climbed mountains and crossed deserts in search of a teacher or a brotherhood or a monastery where they might find knowledge and laws and principles like the Enneagram that you mentioned before that were not available. Today, that knowledge has been made available in the West as a result of the life's work of these people, these teachers from the East and the West. And that's what the story that struck me and what motivated me to write this. Right now, We don't have to go to a mountaintop or cross a desert. In virtually every city in the United States, there are groups and societies that teach the Gurdjieff, the work of Gurdjieff, that are Vedanta study societies, schools of philosophy. The knowledge is available if a person reaches a point in time in his life where he yearns for something more, something deeper.
Hmm. I know that my search, I can only define the beginnings as far as the year was when I turned 17, I began what I referred to as my search. And I remember sort of getting a little bit of a comeuppance when I was at the radio station. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm on my searches. Well, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And I thought, no, once I find Jesus, it's just begun. Because he is just one of so many that I can turn to in terms of the writings in the Bible. But then that opened up more questions, and I had to search further. And that was one of the things that was so intriguing to me. I mean, there's so much out there. And I think that one of the things that is intriguing to me is this time period. Now, this spans roughly right around what? The 1850s to the present. From your perspective, is there something special about this time frame and these individuals coming into this world and doing this kind of work? Or is this just, this is just the natural evolution? Because some would say, hey, this is a very important period in human history.
In every generation, there have been teachers that that taught. But generally, when a teaching, when a profound influence becomes more available to a larger circle of people, it's in response to a need. And there can be no doubt that after 1945, there was a tremendous sense of urgency. And for the first time, mankind had developed the technology and the weaponry to actually destroy life on the planet. This was quite alarming to men and women of reason. It was apparent that superpowers needed to step back from the abyss. It was not very clear whether or not we would actually be able to do so. And it was in that environment that the East reached out to the West and the West reached out to the East. There was this sense that if, in fact, we did not merge these energies, the result could have been catastrophic. There was an historian named Toynbee, he wrote that it's already becoming clear that this story, this chapter, and he was talking about nuclear proliferation, will have to have an Indian ending, because if the energy of the East, of the West and the East do not merge, if we do not develop this attitude and this spirit that make it possible for the human race to grow together into a single family, then this atomic age could lead to the destroying of ourselves. That's quite a profound development in human history. What I find quite interesting is these teachers reached out. You had this influx of influence of the East to the West. You had this proliferation of Eastern philosophy and the practice of meditation and the study of a philosophy of unity and oneness. And coinciding with that work between 1960 and today, you also coinciding with that work, you saw the diminishing of this threat. I mean, in 1989 through 1993, when we watched the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Iron Curtain of the Eastern Bloc, we watched all of that happen virtually without violence, without war.
Mm-hmm.
10 years before that outcome was unimaginable. So there was clearly a shift that happened. It was a shift in understanding. It was a shift in awareness. And people all over the world sought a freedom to pursue something more with their lives. And I believe the spirituality that we've watched grow and the turn of affairs in world events are tied together on some level.
Well, I know that science has begun, and actually more than just begun in the last, I'd say, 10 years or so, to show evidence of our interconnectedness, of our ability collectively to, and I hate the phrase, to change the course of history, because nobody knows what the course will be tomorrow, but to affect events in the world collectively. We can do that. Science is showing that we have that kind of power as a people. And so what happened in 89 through 93, as you've just discussed, it's the same thing that's happening now. You know, people are just getting fed up and they're saying, look, I want to go a different direction. I want a different lifestyle and way of living that doesn't kill me. I'll share something with you that my wife and I were watching a documentary on the Silicon Valley, and they were showing films, clips going back to the 50s and 60s. Do you know that the observation my wife made was the appearance of the people, not what they were wearing, but there were no obese individuals in the camera shots out in public, in malls or shopping centers or wherever the people were congregating. Everybody looked nice and slim and well-groomed. You take that same shot today and you're going to be lucky if you find those slimmed down people. And so it's like that's a more of a physical transformation, but it's the spiritual transformation that I'd like to talk more about in terms of what you've discovered. Have you found that that is something that we're able to do now? I mean, we can change our world if we really wanted to.
The view of these philosophers, these teachers for whom I had the highest respect, was that it was the work of a handful of highly evolved men in each generation that provide a conscious impulse that keep mankind from falling into a worsened yet condition, but that it was the goodness of many that sustained that impulse.
Okay.
And that's really what it's about, is if we seek the truth, if we seek a deeper, more profound understanding of our life, if we seek to work on ourselves and work for the benefit of others, then a part of that is we begin to take care of others, the people and circumstances around us. And this has a transformative effect.
Well, there's no question that people with this kind of mindset, with this kind of consciousness, fit under the category of what Einstein said, that you cannot solve the problems of today or the challenges of today with the consciousness that created them. And so we do need those kinds of people to come along. I'm curious as to how these people, and I haven't actually counted how many you have in the book here, 8 or 10 or 12, what have you, how did these people rise to the top? It's like cream rising to the top of the milk. How did they rise to the top? And people like, say, an Edgar Cayce or a Ruth Montgomery and so forth didn't make the list. What was the criterion that you used to vet these people into the list and others out?
Well, I wouldn't wish to diminish a man like Edgar Cayce. The way this book evolves was when I got out of college, I began to study Eastern philosophy, particularly the work of Gurdjieff and Uspensky. I found a teacher by the name of Mr. Wilhelm Nyland that I had the good fortune to be under his influence for about 5-6 years. And then when he passed on, I found another group. And I had experience with several groups, and I was quite surprised that these independent organizations shared a body of knowledge in common. And I sought to inquire as to who their founders were and in the West and who their sources of knowledge and inspiration were in the East. And so many years, actually decades, went into tracking this down, and there are actually 13 teachers whose stories I tell. Now, these are people that I thought cumulatively, one, they had a profound effect on my life personally. I knew some of them, and I studied the work of the others. And they had a transformative effect on this person's search. It wouldn't be possible to tell the stories of every actor in a play of this scope.
Right, right.
And my aim was just to tell the stories of the people that I came in contact with and that I found to be of a profound influence. And interestingly enough, their lives were connected. They knew one another. They studied one another. And there's a kind of a storyline that develops as this bridge was built between East and West. And I think that's personally what I found so fascinating, what I would have hoped would have been fascinating to the reader. I wrote this book as a service to the teachers that had a profound influence on my own life, and I wrote it because I felt that people, students and other people who seek a profound influence, would be served well to know that our work is possible because we stand on the shoulders of men and women who devoted their lives to this.
I myself find all of this just so fascinating. I have read, I can't believe how many different books I've read, and then there are more books that I have stacked in my library that I haven't touched yet because there are there is just so much. And then to do even one interview a week, and I tend to end up doing more than that, and that's 52 interviews a year. Multiply that times the almost eight years that we've been doing this program. Multiply that times almost 35 years that I've been interviewing. I mean, it's like, who gets an education like that anymore?
That's quite extraordinary,
yes. Yeah. And to absorb it, to want to... to coin the phrase that I've coined many times from the book, A Stranger in a Strange Land, to grok it, to just ingest it and inject it into every cell of my being to better understand. Did you have the desire to find a guru for yourself or a group, or was your desire more the seeking of the truth?
The way I began was a few years after college. I simply found myself feeling vaguely uneasy. I was dissatisfied with my life, my relationships. I wasn't particularly satisfied with the work I was doing for a living. And I just sensed a need for something more, something deeper. I had no idea where to look or what I was looking for. And I encountered some books by Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and their initial descriptions of man's state of mind were irrefutable. And they motivated me to seek out other students of those philosophies and begin to do something about it. There was a desire to be more than what I found myself to be.
I've been through a number of personal growth and development programs, 3 and 5 day intensives. I don't know. Have you ever experienced those kinds of programs, and did you find them in any way, shape, or form beneficial to this search of yours?
I have, and I did. But one must be cautious. There are a lot of things being taught that are not particularly of use. One of the clear indications is if it's being sold as opposed to being taught.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some funding that's required to support any organization, any church, any teaching, any school. But when the numbers begin to become, in one involving serious personal sacrifice, a red flag should go up. Because none of these teachers that I describe were gained any financial gain from their work. They also were not interested in fame. They were mostly anonymous and only known to a very small group of people who chose to become interested in their ideas. So they weren't interested in financial reward. They weren't interested in fame. They worked because they were living according to the principle of learn and teach. Yes, a period of time, 3 days or a week, spent in the company of others, in a setting that allows for contemplation and meditation and study and reflection, have always been a part of the spiritual endeavor, and they're quite profound, and they've always existed. You know, whatever church you attend to probably offers those type of retreats, as well as the philosophies and philosophers. Those retreats are available, yoga retreats and meditation retreats and so on and so forth. And yes, the opportunity to step away from the pulls and, you know, a lot of times the distractions of our everyday affairs and dive deeper, withdraw, rejuvenate, refresh. It's very useful.
Well, I certainly can. I actually went to a retreat center north of Phoenix, my hometown, Phoenix, to what was actually a Catholic monastery in what at that time was across the highway from Black Canyon City. And I spent, 3 or 4 days, and actually somebody dropped me off because at that time I was not driving. And there was that uneasy feeling of, I'm kind of stuck here now, you know, I have no way of leaving, but I could walk across the highway, and actually under, there was a bridge, I could walk under the highway, over to Black Canyon City, go to the grocery store or, you know, what have you, and mingle with people. But the point was to go there, take your bare essentials with you. They had, you know, room, no, there was no board. You brought your own food. And if you wanted entertainment, you brought that. They'd ask you to wear headphones or something like that so you would not disturb anybody else that was there. And they only had 3 or 4 buildings. So it was never like a huge group of people, but you were basically on your own. And that was very interesting, to spend time by oneself and listen to all of the thoughts that just come rushing in. And this wasn't even in the process of doing any kind of meditation. This was like, you know, in the process of walking through the desert and finding a place to sit and draw, because I took a colored pencils and a pad with me. And I found that was really interesting to experience. But I remember as I drew to the end of that, I became extremely anxious. I could not wait for the person to come and pick me up. And it wasn't that the place was a bad place. I was just anxious to get back to the normal world. Now, having lived in the normal world for so many years, and that was only, again, 3 or 4 days. Now it's like, when can I find time to get away from it all, to have some of that contemplative time? What has been your experience in terms of either finding the time to get away or making the time right where you are?
There was a teacher named Muktananda.
Yes.
And he said, he spoke about this. He said, man goes to great trouble to acquire knowledge of the material world. He learns all branches of science, explores the earth, and even travels to the moon. But he never tries to find what exists within himself. Because he is unaware of the enormous power that lies within him, he looks for support in the outer world. Because he doesn't know the boundless happiness that lies inside his heart, he looks for satisfaction in other activities. Because he doesn't experience the inner love, he looks for love from others. He said the truth is that this innermost self of every human being is supremely great, supremely lovable, and that everything is contained within oneself. So he encouraged us to devote some energy to some time to pursuing this inner world. And what we find at times, you know, the interest waxes and wanes. You know, there are times when we're totally engrossed and involved in business and family and profession and don't give much of a thought to anything else. And then there are times when we find a need to reflect.
Yeah.
To have some quiet time. Everybody takes a vacation. The question is, how do they spend that vacation?
Yeah. I've jokingly said to people that I'm literarily challenged because I haven't read most of the classics that most people have and so forth. But I don't feel necessarily deprived. By the same token, I'm kind of anxious to get to them. I would love to know what's in those pages of the bits and pieces that I've heard from other people who have described those kinds of things. And that kind of goes to, I think, an important fact that you've talked about here in this program, and that is that this truth you must seek, it cannot be given to you. And there is something in that process of seeking and finding that is, quite honestly, not only in terms of the aha experience, but quite satisfying and rewarding when you do find it, as opposed to somebody just handing it to you.
Yes, it really is a great sense of adventure. These teachers that I write about in East Meets West discovered sacred laws and universal principles. They didn't discover them. They just, they refreshed their memory of them. And they conveyed it to us. They made it available to people to the extent to which they wish to have it and incorporate it in their actual life.
Tell me about the spiritual aspects of this information. There's a phrase quite often used by some of my guests who will access what are called the Akashic Records, supposedly this etheric library that one can access information about darn near anything. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts about acquiring that kind of information, be it through that modality or just through one's own intuition or still small voice, or some would say our higher self or the voice of God that we hear speaking inside us?
It isn't really all that mystical. I believe everyone's had the experience of going to bed with a problem or a dilemma and waking up the next morning and there's simply knowledge there that wasn't available the night before. Somehow that knowledge arose from the depths of our own being. What these teachers taught was that knowledge and happiness is, in fact, a part of essentially what we are. Mm-hmm. And that we simply need to come to ourselves, remember ourselves, penetrate below the superficial concerns and activities, penetrate below the circling thoughts and daydreams and constant fluctuating emotions that tend to govern so much of our lives, and underneath we find all the knowledge that we need. The knowledge is there of ourselves. The knowledge is there of what the next step before us is. And if we endeavor to take that step, we find that we also have the strength to take that step. There's justice in the creation. And if we seek, the knowledge will be known, and we will find that we have the strength to take the step before us.
There's a wonderful poem by, I believe the name is James Talbot, but the last name Talbot, having to do with where shall we hide the truth from man? And this is the gods speaking, and they converse over, well, where are we going to hide? Because if man finds the truth, he'll be like us. So the certain element of feeling threatened, I guess. And so they thought, well, we'll hide it on a mountaintop. No, man will find a way to climb it. Well, we'll hide it in the depths of the sea. No, man will find a way to get down there. We'll hide it in outer space. No, man will find a way to get there, and so on and so on. And they go down this litany of ideas. And finally, one says, I know. Let's hide it in his heart. He'll never look there.
As it says in the Upanishads, from time to time, a daring man looks back. within and discovers the truth of himself.
And that's where the journeyback.net comes from, I would suspect.
Yes, that's the name of my website, thejourneyback.net. And what it's referring to is this journey that, as I said, the sense that I have of it is that each man has to find his own unique way. I mean, he may join millions in the practice of a particular religion or hundreds of thousands in the study of a particular philosophy, but how he blends these efforts that he makes, the way he balances his pursuit of and spirituality and knowledge with his profession and with his family responsibilities and with his duties and obligations to the community, that's an individual matter.
Yeah, I wish that others would respect that. You know, it's like my relationship with my creator is, guess what? Mine. And I don't have to justify it to anyone. I don't even have to justify it to myself. I know that it's there.
I think what that stems from is, and you will hear most organizations and philosophies are accused of being, of stating that they're the only one.
Yeah.
In actuality, that's not what they're stating. The fact of the matter is the way nature is set up is you have to find one way.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just going around sampling a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and leaving, it's like a buffet. You can't, I'll take some of this and I'll take some of that. No, I don't like that. You don't get anywhere. One must reach a point where he finds a teacher or a discipline or a teaching or a religious practice or approach to life, and then he begins to dig his well there. He needs to penetrate within himself. He needs to penetrate in his understanding of the truth. We're talking about a process of inner transformation that involves the raising of one's level of understanding, the raising of one's level of being. And this requires work and commitment.
So Uspensky's quote at the back of your book that I read, you elucidated, so are you... is that sort of your philosophy? And to that end, you were born and raised a Catholic. Where are you today?
I'm a practicing Catholic.
So you have sort of taken...
a student of Vedanta.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I meditate. And I've studied the writings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky and other philosophers, and the writings and the conversations of a teacher in the East by the name of Shantananda Saraswati, who taught some of these teachers, and I've attempted to apply it in my life.
Mm-hmm.
This desire to refine who and what I am is the aim and purpose of my life. But what has been taught does not require giving up anything or seclusion from society. This is practiced in life.
Right.
I have a family. I have a business. I've written a book. I lead a full life of family and profession and community. But that does not, I do not allow that to overwhelm this impulse to go deeper, to deepen my understanding. This search for truth is a journey toward infinity.
Wow. And what I'm hearing you say is that there is no conflict or contradiction between the things that you are doing and the search and the deeper aspects of your practicing Catholic life.
That's correct. Now, once again, that's my approach.
Yes.
I've been in philosophy groups where people did not practice their religion. I've been in philosophy groups where people practiced their Judaism. I've been in philosophy groups that had a mix and a blending. Some of my fellow students took great effort to pass on their religious tradition to their children. Others thought that was not necessary. It's not it's not my place to judge. For myself, I was born into a Catholic tradition. I had a devout faith as a child. And when I, later on, when I discovered philosophy, it was essential to reconcile the two philosophies, as it were,
mm-hmm.
because I knew that one was the truth, and I knew that what I met was the truth. And I think most people have to make that reconciliation between what they're learning and what they already know is valuable and true. And then the key, of course, is to live this life, as it says over the temple at Adelphi, take nothing in excess. So we're not asked to give up anything. We're just asked to give up too much of anything.
Right. As my father always told me, everything in moderation. Even moderation.
That's right. Even moderation.
Even moderation.
And that's true, because if one is to live a life where they're attending to what they believe is important and leaving some time for contemplation and inner growth and inner penetration, well, then some other activities are going to fall by the wayside.
Hmm.
But that's a matter of the individual's choice.
Yeah. I've even a very strong or very prominent aspect of Catholic teaching has been about sacrifice. And I used to tell people, oh, yeah, I come from a really big family. You know, my parents had 6 kids, of which I'm one. They must have sacrificed a lot. And that kind of perplexed me at first, and I finally went to my parents, and I says, so what did you guys sacrifice to have us, to have this big family? And my mother says, we sacrificed nothing, because this is what we wanted to do. And that was an interesting perspective that she shared with me. And so when one begins this kind of search and delves deep within oneself, the things that don't fit fall away.
Yes. And they didn't sacrifice anything. They had a lot of joy.
Yeah.
A lot of happiness. And the relationships and family are among the closest that we find in that life. And they had a very full life.
Yeah.
Uspensky said something interesting. He said, the first thing we have to sacrifice is our unnecessary suffering. When I read that, I said, boy, I'm all for that.
Yes.
I've got plenty of suffering that I'm not getting anything of value from whatsoever. And I was very happy to begin to discover the sources of this pain and frustration that seemed to leave me very puzzled and out of control of my life. And these teachers helped me to do that, to get rid of this unnecessary pain.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that there isn't work to be done, that there's not striving. And striving for the good can at times be painful. We will be asked to carry our cross.
Yeah.
We will be asked to be understanding with others, even when they're behaving in ways that we might not wish to be understanding of.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the great lessons that Christian Station taught me was when I would conduct my interviews, each of the individuals had their own particular philosophy about or perspective on the various rules and regulations and so forth, that they didn't necessarily buy into all 10 or 20 or whatever it was. And I think it was summed up best by a Christian musician by the name of John Fisher. He moved from California, where he was raised in the Jesus movement, moved to New England. And we were in the midst of an interview where, you know, he says, yeah, sometimes I look out this window and I see the leaves turning and it's great. But one of the most profound things that he came across was he started asking himself the question, is what I believe or what I have been taught to believe? And it sounds like you went through that same process through the investigation of these other philosophies.
Yes. Gurdjieff, one of the teachers I wrote about, His description of mankind isn't particularly flattering. He said basically we're an accumulation of thoughts and feelings that we've learned from others. He compared us to machines that simply reacted to circumstances and events with the things we learned through example and the things that became a part of us through habits and repetition. In that state, he said we weren't really men and women, quote, created in the image of God, that there was a higher potential, that in every generation, a few people could strive to become more than what they were. And he and others provided the knowledge and the inspiration for their followers to do so.
I find that when a teacher does that, it, to me, is more intellectually honest, both with self and with the others. I remember as a Baha'i, and I was a Baha'i for a year and a half, it was real interesting the discussions we had at what they had, what they called the firesides. And I remember having a private conversation with someone who was sharing with me. And I says, yeah, but, you know, don't I have the freedom to search other books and other places? And, oh, absolutely. But I loved the come around was, but you'll end up coming right back here, which I thought was very interesting philosophically. Like, really? You think so? You know, I'm looking to expand. You know, not to end up someplace. I'm kind of enjoying the journey. I have no idea where I'm going to end up, but it's the learning and the growth that I hope to not only take in, but also impart to others. And I'm curious about your feelings about what you are imparting to others. Where is your level of responsibility in that regard?
Well, it's to speak the truth to the best of my ability.
Okay.
At the moment, the aim is to simply make known the lives and the work and the philosophies of these people who had such a profound influence on my life. I feel indebted to do so. And I feel it's quite a worthwhile endeavor. There's nothing more that one can do than learn the truth, then strive to live according to the truth, and then speak the truth.
Mm. And some days that's easier than others. I think
yes.
You would agree.
Yes. This is quite challenging.
But it's definitely, there is no question, it is definitely rewarding. And I have to say, one of the beautiful things about the universe in my life is that I've managed to, I think, maintain a fairly even keel as far as my ego is concerned in this industry that I'm in. Because when I start, and thank goodness I haven't gone in that direction for a long, long time, but when I did start to drift off into that, I'm such a wonderful person and I do such great work and da da da. The universe has a way of providing me with an experience that gives me my comeuppance.
Yes.
And I've listened and I've learned. And so I'm grateful for the gifts that I have to offer, for the talents that I have. I'm very grateful for all of that. And I didn't get here on my own.
Yeah.
I owe where I am, even at this very moment, I owe it to you, John, and to every guest I've had and I've talked with, to all of the people I've worked with, and to my parents in particular. So, you know, we don't arrive at the place that we are from a vacuum, you know. And we are beholden to the rest of our society and our peers and so forth. For, you know, no matter what happened in our childhood, the good, the bad, and the ugly. This has been a most extraordinary interview, and I am, again, grateful for you sharing your story. And I want to let our listeners know, A, the website that they can go to is thejourneyback.net. That's thejourneyback.net. The book is entitled East Meets West by John Adago. It is the stories of remarkable men and women in the East and West who built a bridge across a cultural divide and introduced meditation and Eastern philosophy to the West. And John, I thank you for introducing us to East Meets West and for being on the program today.
Well, thank you very much. That is available through bookstores or through Amazon in paperback and e-books. And now after that commercial, I want to say thank you very much. This was the most remarkable conversation. And at times I forgot that we were on the air, but it was a very fine conversation. Thank you very much.
I have three final questions, and you can elucidate them in any way you choose. The first is, who is John Adago?
A student of the truth, a man who, after getting out of college, sought deeper answers, lived in New York most of my life, had a business as a, developed two businesses, one in construction and one in real estate, have a family with three children and grandchildren. So those are the facts around an ordinary life. What makes me perhaps a little different from others is that I've devoted most of my adult life to this search for something deeper through study and seeking out the company of people that I thought had more, were further along than I was, and devoting energy and time to finding groups and meeting with those groups and meditating and contemplating and study, I found a deeper sense of purpose than what I had when I started.
What is it, though you have expressed this probably throughout the interview, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, the master teachers speak of realization, that is, realizing the highest purpose of a human life. This beginning to identify this sense of self with something much larger, the permanent state of awareness that myself and yourself and the self of all are in truth one.
I like that. Finally, how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, first, we have almost absolute power over our own life. The law, as Jesus expressed it, was we reap what we sow. And in my own life, that has, there's no doubt about that. So there are consequences to our actions, there are consequences to our decisions. And we are governed by law. So that's a big part of it.
And they can reach you through thejourneyback.net. Find out more about East Meets West. John Adago, thank you again for joining us on the program.
Good afternoon, sir. It was a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.